Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
So nice to see so many people here on such a beautiful Sunday morning, and I hope you'll all get out in the sun part of today anyway. I wanted to talk today a bit about karma, which we've been talking about interdependence in some form or another all month. And karma is an interesting principle of Buddhism, I might say, that's problematic for some of us because it comes from a different cultural context, and the way that it is described can sometimes create issues for us when we think about karma. So I wanted to talk a bit about it in terms of how I understand it and how it works for me. Karma is really, we say it's the law of cause and effect. It's really the mechanism by which interdependence happens. If we don't have cause and effect, we don't really have interdependence. We just have a kind of chaotic mush of things going on. It's kind of like the laws of physics. Gravity, for example, or for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, those kinds of things. It's, in other words, this interdependence that we have is not random. There's a kind of a rhyme and a reason to it. And if we use the concept of karma, it's a way to describe that mechanism to ourselves in a way that we can begin to work with it and work with the interdependence in our daily lives in a way that's more useful. So oftentimes when we hear the word karma, oh, it's my karma, you know, it's this sense of fate or predetermination. And in fact, there is a strong sense of that in some cultures, that karma creates a sense of predetermination. When I go into the prison, there was one prison group several years ago that wanted to talk about karma, and I was explaining kind of how I saw it. And one young man from a Southeast Asian country put up his hand. He said, oh, that's not karma. That's not karma at all. And I said, tell me how you understand karma. And he said, well, you know, I'm here because I killed a man. And my grandmother told me, because you kill a man, now next life you're going to be cockroach. Oh, that's it's interesting. Your grandmother knows more about this than I do. But I said, if that's the case, how come you come every week and meditate and study the teachings if you're going to be a cockroach coming around? He said, well, he said, I do this because maybe the life after this, I won't be cockroach anymore. And so even though it was a very literal and different way of looking at karma than it is for me, the point that was helpful about it to him was you can make a difference going forward. So whether you think of reincarnation in terms of past lives and future lives, or you think of it moment by moment by moment, which is a more Zen understanding of it, is that each moment we're born and we die, we're born and we die. Each moment starts fresh. Whichever way you are looking at this idea of reincarnation, karma can be very helpful as a way to understand how to move forward in our lives. A lot of what we're doing in our practice is learning how to understand what's really going on and to discern what causes what. So our happiness, our own personal happiness, depends on our actions, right? We all understand that. Whether we create causes of suffering in our lives or we create the causes of happiness in our lives. Generally speaking, we tend to miss the mark because we have a misunderstanding about how the world really works. And so we think that we can gather things, we can gather people, we can gather experiences and make our life happy in that way. And that's not going to last as happiness. All of that is very transient, and so it creates suffering to cling to that. And we understand that in an intellectual way, but all of our practice is about embodying that and really feeling that at a gut level and being able to live that at a gut level. Everything arises due to many causes and conditions, some of which we can identify or even guess at, and some of which we have no way of knowing. People often ask me, why did you decide to become ordained? That's a legitimate question. And usually my answer to that is, I don't know. I have no idea. I can tell you a story about why I became ordained, but that's just a story, and it doesn't take into account all of the many causes in my past that I don't really think about or I don't know about that have put me on the trajectory that I'm on. So it sounds like a kind of jokey, teasy Zen answer, oh, I don't know, life is a mystery kind of thing, but it's really true. How can I know? I can tell you what I did to become ordained and why I thought I did that, but that's not going to be the whole story. It never is the whole story for anything that's happening. The Dzogchen Panlop Rinpoche, who is a teacher in the Tibetan tradition, says, when past karmic causes and current karmic conditions meet, we have 100% of all the factors that will determine a specific result. That's his way of describing karma. Everything that happens, happens as a result of many causes and conditions. And the causes would be, we might kind of conveniently think of those as in the past. They precede whatever this incident is, and the conditions are what's coming at it and influencing it at this time. So for example, we might say in a very simplistic way, I have a seed for a cucumber plant, and I plant that and it grows into a cucumber plant. It doesn't generally grow into a tomato plant or, you know, a sunflower or something like that. So it would be very surprising if it did. We know that it's geared that way. However, all the conditions around it, the sunlight, the nutrients, whether I pay attention and water it or not, all of that will influence how it grows as a cucumber plant, whether it produces cucumbers or not. The weather, which nobody has any control over, is also a condition that can affect that plant. So we can see things in a very simplistic way, but then if we go back, you know, into the various causes that come into it, we can really see that there's a wide range of them. How did I have the money to get the seed, or did somebody give me the seed in exchange for something else? Or were they out of cucumber seeds at the store when I went to get them? There are all these factors that come in, and we don't generally think about them. They're just not that important because you got the seed, you're going to go ahead and plant it. But to be able to at least explore and see how wide and broad that accumulation of causes can be for any situation, that's a really good exercise for us to do. Because there will be things that are much more consequential, honestly, than planting one cucumber seed might be. And so if we can practice that in these smaller, more easy to manage circumstances, then they become useful in other situations. Traditionally speaking, the karmic strength of an action depends on several different stages of that action. So intention, why you want to do something, for example, is a key factor. So there's an intention, there's creating a plan based on that intention, there's initiating that plan, you start it, then you complete it, and finally you look back on that and say, oh, I'm, you know, that's what I meant to do, I intended to do it, I'm happy about it, done. So there are five stages really for each action that we perform, and each one, to the extent that we fill each of those out, it strengthens the karmic effect of that action. And you might say, well, that sounds really kind of gobbledygook, but here's an example. The young man that killed another man intended to kill him. That was his intention. He was angry at him. He thought about it. He decided to kill him, and he carried that plan out and wasn't sorry about it till he got caught, of course. But then that was carrying that act through all five stages. Very strong karmic effect. But what if you're somebody in a harness up on a tall building in downtown Seattle cleaning windows, and you have a bucket of water and a squeegee and you're cleaning, and you turn this way and accidentally knock the bucket off, it falls down, hits somebody on the head and kills. It's a terrible tragedy. You didn't intend to do that. So the intention wasn't there, you didn't plan to do that, you didn't consciously start and carry out that action, and your response after that was, oh my God, I can't believe that. I feel terrible, I've killed somebody. So very different karmic effect. Same action, somebody has died, and that family is now missing that person. It's the same effect for them, but a very different karmic effect for you. It's gonna make your life unfold in different ways. In the first case, you end up in prison. In the second case, there's a whole other set of circumstances that will unfold from that. So it's important to see that this intention is critical. Initially, our intention is we're uncomfortable, we're in pain, we don't understand what's going on, and so there's a certain self-survival intention behind our actions. Hopefully we can grow that. Hopefully as we begin to understand the effect that our actions have on other people, we begin to take their needs into account as well, so that it becomes a way of interdependence with those people. There's, here's a story that one of my family's stories that helps me kind of to understand how this works. And it's, again, it's about somebody dying at the hand of somebody else. I was in a workshop yesterday, which was geared towards teaching people of different political persuasions how to talk to each other about issues they disagree on. It's hard work. It's very hard work. The issue that we chose was immigration, which is a hot button, and a lot of us have some very strong feelings about it, very deeply held values around it. So it was a very interesting exercise to do this. But it brought up in my own mind a story from my family's past. My great-grandfather and his wife, my great-grandmother, emigrated from Germany to the United States. And he had been a very well-known painter throughout Europe. He had done paintings inside of churches, beautiful murals, and he was particularly known for being able to outline in gilt paint. So he could, he had a very steady hand and he could outline things very well. And so he was known throughout Europe for being able to do that. And in fact, was brought to England. They came to England because he was asked to repaint portions of Buckingham Palace. So it was a big deal to do that. And he met the king at the time. And so that was another family, part of the family lore, was that he had this high point in his career. And he decided, well, I'm doing so well, I'm going to go to the United States and paint churches there. They landed in New Haven, Connecticut, he and my great-grandmother. And I don't know if you know, all the churches up there are just whitewashed. They're all congregational churches. Very plain, very simple, no gilt, you know, nothing like that. So he was flat out of work. I mean, he was useless there. And so he had to find other ways to make a living. He, at one point, he was wandering through the forests of Pennsylvania, stripping bark off of trees to sell to tanneries to tan leather. They stripped the bark off to get the tannin out of it. So the family story, very, very poor, and finally ended up painting houses just as a common laborer. Didn't speak English very well and got treated the way immigrants tend to get treated in that situation. What happened was he began drinking heavily and was often out getting into fights in bars. This is a story I'm very familiar with from the prisons. And one time he got into a fight and died as a result of the injuries from that fight. So the family story is, oh, how terrible, how poor, you know, poor immigrant, and he was, you know, put in this situation and his life fell apart and then he was killed as a result of a bar fight. And when Charlie, my husband, first started working at the prosecutor's office, he was saying that what he noticed going into court as a criminal prosecutor was that one week there would be one set of defendants and a set of witnesses and victims. The next week, they would change places. He said, it's all the same cars in the parking lot every week. It's just that you never know which side of the courtroom they're going to come into. It's like, oh, who is it? Oh, interesting, yeah. You know, last week you were complaining that somebody was beating you up, and this week you're the one beating somebody up. And I thought, oh. My great-grandfather could easily have landed the punch that killed the other person. How different it could be. So you begin to see that the choices that we make put us in circumstances where things can unfold certain ways. And causes and conditions, this inconceivable karma that we have, come together in a certain way. It's not as though my great-grandfather was somehow more special and the other person was less special, that this is what happened. This is what happened and their lives unfolded differently as a result. My life could have unfolded very differently if my great-grandfather had been the one ending up in prison. Who knows? It's a very interesting story. Karma doesn't mean that we give away our sense of agency, but we need to be able to appreciate all the subtleties that bring us to this place in time and circumstance and how we make choices going forward. Right? My great-grandfather made some poor choices. He was also in a very difficult spot as an immigrant. So both of those things were going on. And I don't know that you can say one weighs more than the other. How can you say that? We don't know all the circumstances that go into that. And whether or not, another aspect of this is whether or not we believe in reincarnation as in future lives, our ancestors' choices make they reverberate down through history. They reverberate down through time. For generation after generation, the choices they make. So that's not reincarnation in the sense of another body, but it is carried out beyond the span of our life. So it's another aspect of karma that we need to be aware of. So his story, it was initially just a family story, explaining how it was we came to this country and what it was like for us coming to this country, but it's also, it shapes how I work with the men in the prison. My understanding of what happened to my grandfather makes me realize that these are choices that people make. They can continue to make new choices based on new information, based on their understanding of how things have unfolded, and so that this is a very positive thing. It's worth allowing people the opportunity to make new choices and move on from that place in their life. It's also important, as we look at karma, to examine the state of our mind before we act in body, speech, or mind. So whether we're thinking something, whether we're saying something, or whether we're acting, we need to really pay attention to that. Now, I don't mean that we need to stop doing, we couldn't function if we were trying to do this moment after moment after moment, but oftentimes we'll do something and we'll go, huh, that didn't go as well as I'd hoped, you know, and we can look at it in terms of what was the state of my mind when I said that, when I did that, what was the state of my mind when I thought that, why would I allow myself into that place? Yesterday's workshop was very helpful in this, examining the state of our mind, to be able to have some kindness and curiosity about a situation instead of being closed-minded about it. To say, okay, give me, this is information I need to hear. I'm curious about your point of view on this. So if we don't do this, we tend to reinforce certain tendencies within ourselves. If we have a certain story that we tell, we tend to collect the information that reinforces that story and ignore the stuff that doesn't fit that story. That's why it's important to recognize a story is just a story. It's a set of things we've woven together like that. And it's also important as we do this to not pass judgment on ourselves if we notice that we were acting in a very selfish way, for example, or out of ignorance. We don't want to say, oh, I was a terrible person, I was selfish in that action. That's not what this is aiming for. What we're trying to do is tune into our intention as we're acting and understand why we're doing what we're doing. If we have a clear understanding of what our actual intention is or was, then we're in a better position to change it than if we kid ourselves about it. Sometimes we just act without thinking, right? And we might say, I didn't really have an intention. This is just this kind of habit thing. I acted out of habit. That's a kind of selfish way of being, is to just do what's comfortable, what's easy for me to do. But again, to judge ourselves as being less than as a result of that is not helpful. If we can look at it and say, wow, look at what that did. That had this effect. I want to try something that's a little more generous, a little more broad-minded next time, and see if I can be a little less of a butt about this. You know, in a conversation, this is often the case, something comes out of our mouth before we're aware of it, and we go, ooh, wish I could reel that back in. We're just jumping out without thinking about how it might affect the other person. And oftentimes, we might do an act and try to assume what the intention is, either on our part or another person's part, from the action itself. And an example would be an act of generosity. Somebody gives somebody something. And we say, oh, wasn't that nice they did that? How generous of them. But they may have a less than generous intention behind it. So our motivation might be to look generous. You know, look what I did. Wasn't I good? Or to have the recipient like me. I'm going to give them this because then they'll like me. Or perhaps it's because we want the recipient to feel beholden to us. We give them something and now they've got to reciprocate. So there are all these possible ways that we can do something that looks generous, and yet in fact the motivation, the intention behind it is not so generous. So to be able to be honest about that, we have to not be judgmental about ourselves and just say, okay, I did that. How could I do that differently next time? It's good to learn our mental landscape as we proceed. That's absolutely critical for really working with karma. And then lastly, thinking about karma, I've been talking about it in a kind of a individual way, but there's also a collective karma that we have. So as a group, we may do something. As a country, we may do something. As a country, we may find ourselves in a certain situation. And karma can help us also analyze this. You know, oftentimes, for example, we at least what I hear is that there's a lot of blaming some other group, some other person, for the situation in the country today. All of us are present in this country today. Therefore, all of us bear some responsibility. We have part of this collective karma about the conditions in this country today. So the issue is not who can we blame, but what can I do? What is the thing that I can contribute? And if we can look at the causes of a situation, all of the causes, not just the ones that we want to point out, but there's some other causes as well, and our own personal connection to those causes. That's one way in which we're going to make smarter decisions about how to proceed going forward. This is a really critical use of karma. Interdependence really is about this, that there's no clear distinction between our individual action and our collective action. Our individual action affects the collection of beings that we're with, and so we can't really separate them out. So,
this podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.